Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Missing Justice ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you can have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way. And that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are designed by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Don't waste time on apps that don't work. Babbel's conversation-based teaching prepares you for real-life situations. And studies from Yale, Michigan State University, and others continue to prove Babbel is better. One study found that using Babbel for 15 hours is equivalent to a full semester at college. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, at babbel.com/truecrime. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/truecrime, spelled BABBEL.com/truecrime. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This episode contains reenactments of court transcripts and graphic descriptions of a deadly crime scene. Please listen with care. We went to Billings, Montana in December of 2021 to witness the trial of Gerard David Three Fingers, a member of the Northern Cheyenne tribe.
We just pulled up to the federal courthouse in Billings, Montana, and I'm trying to put myself in the family's shoes right now, but what the long road was to reach this point. It was 647 days, I counted, from when Christy was killed. But now they're here, and this trial is just beginning. I'm sure nerves are very high, and we will be watching.
Bo, do you have your press badge?
Yeah. Inside the courthouse, we pass Alita, Ryal, and other members of Christy's family. A family advocate from the court is explaining what they can expect from the trial. She warns the family not to look at any of the photos taken of Christy's body so that they'll remember Christy as they knew her. We shuffle into the wood-paneled courtroom with high vaulted ceilings. The entire room is lit with natural light. There are two sets of five benches that make up the gallery. Christy's family takes up nearly every seat on the left side. Sitting to the right is Gerard's mother, alone. They've all made the hour and a half drive west from the Northern Cheyenne Reservation. Lawyers start to trickle in, and we see them walk past the bar, which has an intricate steel etching of native teepees and buffalo. One of them is the prosecutor, Assistant U.S. Attorney Brian Dake. Another is Gerard's attorney, federal public defender Jillian Gosch. A U.S. Marshal ushers in Gerard. He's wearing a white and blue checkered shirt with jeans. His black hair is neatly pulled back into a braided ponytail. He sits down next to his lawyers, facing the empty seats of the jury box. The judge, Susan P. Waters, enters and is soon followed by the 13 jurors. They appear to range in age from early 20s to early 70s. Eight women, five men. All but one appear to be white.
The court has set aside this time to hear the matter of CR-20-101-BLG-SPW, United States versus Gerard David Three Fingers.
Assistant U.S. Attorney Brian Dake begins his opening statement for the prosecution. And again, what you're about to hear are actors reenacting court transcripts.
On March 6th, 2020, Gerard David Three Fingers killed Christy Woodenthigh. The two, along with others, were drinking alcohol throughout the afternoon on the 6th.
Dake explained to the jury the government's case. Gerard, according to the prosecution, was responsible for Christie's death. Dake replayed the details of what allegedly happened that night.
At some point, Gerard Threefingers ended up in the driver's seat of his silver Ford Explorer. Christie Wittenthal met him outside.
In his opening statement, he laid out a version of events that were similar to what we heard Gerard say in his police interview in the last episode. Dake said Christie was standing outside of Gerard's driver's side door. The two had been arguing, and that Christie was grabbing at the door handle when her hand got caught.
Mr. Threefingers was driving the car. Ms. Wittenthal then got her right leg caught in the back left wheel of Mr. Gerard Threefingers' Ford Explorer.
This, Dake said, is what killed Christie. He told the jury that Gerard then picked up Christie's body and drove to his mother's house. After this summary of March 6th, Assistant U.S. Attorney Dake explained that he would be calling 7 witnesses to prove his case. His argument was that Gerard acted recklessly that night, driving so close to Christie after drinking that day.
At the end of this case, the United States will ask that you find him guilty of involuntary manslaughter. Thank you.
The prosecutor was calm but assertive in his opening. What would come next struck a very different tone.
Angry, aggressive, assaultive. Those words describe the demeanor of Christie Wittenthal in the minutes shortly before her death.
Before she even reached the podium microphone, attorney Jillian Gosch raised her voice and told the jury that Christie was angry, aggressive, and assaultive. In her opening, she described a similar scene to the jury, that Christie and Gerard were partying with other people at the house. But then she said Christie's mood changed.
She started to become increasingly aggressive. She punched Gerard in the face.
Gosch said Gerard was parked outside the house because Christie was fighting with another woman.
Eventually, the fight stops and Christie leaves the residence. Where does she go? Right out to that car. Knocks on the window. Gerard rolls it down. She immediately starts throwing punches. He then rolls the window up, starts the car, and she pulls the handle. She pulls the handle as the car is pulling away. And you heard the government describe the nature of the injuries that Christie suffered as a result of that.
Gerard's attorney continued to defend her client.
There's simply no evidence that there was any sort of reckless driving, unusual driving, or any kind of aggressive driving on the part of Gerard.
With each turn in the story, Gosch focused a lot of attention on Christie that night. She said Gerard cooperated with police and she made a point to tell the jury that he wasn't slurring his words. In contrast, Gosch noted that, according to her autopsy, Christie tested positive for methamphetamine, which was the first time we had heard that. Gosch ended her opening statement like this.
We believe that at the end of this case, that it will be very clear to you that the individual who caused her own death is Christie. She is the individual who took those steps and actions. All Gerard did was try to get away. And at the end of this case, we are going to ask that you find him not guilty.
But what Gosch didn't tell the jury was that in addition to focusing on Christie's behavior, she was going to turn the spotlight on the Bureau of Indian Affairs federal agents. She would question every step of their investigation, how these police officers handled Gerard, processed the crime scene, and collected evidence. And what the officers admitted under oath left Christie's family outraged. Gerard Threefingers' trial was a long time coming for Christie's family. So sitting there in the courtroom, they felt both hopeful that they were finally having their day in court, but also nervous, because by the time they got to Christie's house that night, there were no police officers there. And the two-day trial affirmed their biggest fears. Testimony of 3 BIA federal agents indicated that serious investigative mistakes were made the night Christie died. Audio recordings weren't allowed inside the courtroom, so what you're hearing from the trial are reenactments directly quoting the official court transcript we obtained. We're going to walk you through the shocking testimony of each of those 3 BIA agents and show how the choices they made impacted the case against Gerard. From CBS News, I'm Kara Cordy.
And I'm Beau Erickson.
This is Missing Justice, Episode 4. The U.S. versus Gerard David Threefingers. One One of the three officers that the prosecution called to the stand was 18-year BIA veteran Harley Walker.
And as he walked to that witness stand, Officer Walker looked very professional. He was wearing his official navy blue BIA uniform, and his hair was buzzed short.
And from his testimony, we learned that he was one of the first officers to respond to Gerard's mother's house that night. He said that when he pulled up, there was already an ambulance there, parked beside Gerard's silver Ford Explorer.
The jury and courtroom were shown photos of this scene. We saw Gerard's SUV, and it looked like it was caked in dirt. The mud was almost as high as the door handles, and it looked like it wrapped around the entire vehicle.
As Officer Walker got closer, he said he noticed that the rear passenger door was open. He looked inside and saw a woman who he'd come to learn was Christy.
Photos of Christy's body, still in the SUV, were also presented to the jury on monitors in front of their seats. These photos were not shown to the courtroom gallery, so Christy's family didn't see them at all. But from our vantage point in the courtroom, we actually could see these photos, and they were very hard to take in. Christy's body was lying face down on the back seat with her legs on the floor. Her torso was exposed, revealing deep bruising on her right side. Her clothes were torn, dirty, and bloody. And Officer Walker said EMS declared Christy dead on arrival.
Okay, so the prosecution was using Walker to kind of illustrate the scene. Next, Assistant U.S. Attorney Day asked questions about Officer Walker's role that night.
And what did you observe about Mr. Three Fingers?
He seemed like he was distraught. He also appeared to be either intoxicated or I could smell when I spoke with him. I could smell alcohol on his breath.
The courtroom also saw pictures of Gerard from that night, and he looks a little different now than he did 21 months ago. In the photos, Gerard's black hair was cut short and he had a scraggly mustache and goatee. We also noticed that when these photos were taken that night, Gerard was wearing a black hoodie that said, Northern Cheyenne, Search and Rescue.
During Officer Walker's testimony was also when the jury was played the four-minute interview conducted by BIA Special Agent Jonathan Whitefoot, the interview you heard in our last episode.
Start knocking, trying to be aggressive towards me.
And you may remember how hard it was to understand Gerard in that recording. And when it was defense attorney Jillian Gosch's turn to ask questions, she didn't shy away from that. She asked Officer Walker to describe his observations of Gerard.
He seemed distraught.
And that would be a normal reaction for somebody that was involved in this type of incident.
Yes.
This was a brief exchange, but we think Gosch did something important here. She seemed to be trying to signal to the jury that what they heard was Gerard's emotions, not drunkenness. And Gosch is using Walker's experience of 18 years in law enforcement to validate Gerard's distraught emotional nature.
But then she started poking holes in Officer Walker's credibility.
Okay, now you didn't write a report in this case, is that right?
Correct.
Okay, but you had a clear recollection of what happened back in March of 2020.
Yes.
This was stunning. The defense attorney just got Officer Walker to admit that he didn't write a report of what happened that night. And Gosch just kept going. She asked Walker how many calls he had been on since that night Christy died. And he said over 300 calls. So we were thinking, how could he remember all of the important details of this case?
Then Gosch really drove home the importance of documentation for the jury.
Now, is it your common practice to write a report after you go out on a call?
Yes.
Okay, so in this particular case, which is a very serious offense, you didn't write a report.
Correct.
Why?
Because I had a supporting role during the investigation. I didn't have a direct role.
Is that the policy of the BIA?
No.
What is the policy for the BIA if you respond to a scene?
You should write a report.
And the reason that you would want to write a report is so that the details of that incident are memorialized for, you know, future court proceedings.
Correct.
I have nothing further, Your Honor.
According to the more than 650-page BIA law enforcement handbook that we obtained, it says all criminal events must be documented in a report in a thorough and timely manner. But sitting in the gallery, it seemed like Gosch's defense strategy was becoming clear. She had already questioned Christie's behavior, and now she got a BIA federal agent to admit to not following standard procedure even when responding to a homicide.
Another BIA agent to take the stand was Marlon Audibeau. Like most of his colleagues there, he had a long career with the BIA. But after 21 years, Audibeau had recently retired. So he walked into the courtroom in a turquoise button-down, but still had that high and tight haircut. Audibeau was responsible for handling and transporting Gerard that night, so the prosecution asked him about Gerard's behavior. Audibeau testified that Gerard's eyes were bloodshot, and he could smell the odor of alcohol on Gerard's body.
What else did you observe about his behavior?
Well, you know, it was an emotional time for everybody, and, you know, he was a little emotional.
What do you mean by that, he was a little emotional?
He didn't really say too much. I mean, I didn't, like I said, I didn't talk to him just because of the ongoing scenario, the scene and everything. So, you know, I just observed and made sure, you know, I believe he did have scratches on his face.
Did he appear upset to you?
I don't know if he was more upset or just more scared and, you know, and to me, intoxicated.
Because of those scratches, Officer Audibeau said that he put Gerard into his cruiser and drove the few miles to Indian Health Services, the clinic on the reservation. Officer Audibeau confirmed that it was BIA protocol to take a suspect with visible injuries to receive medical attention. Audibeau testified that Gerard was cleaned up by the clinic staff. Audibeau then drove him to a BIA detention center because, regardless of the circumstances around Christie's death, Gerard was going to be held that night for drinking. When it was time for defense attorney Gosch to question Marlon Audibeau, she wasted no time in getting him to explain why he made certain choices that night.
Good afternoon. So let me ask you this.
Okay.
So this is a very serious offense, right?
Yes.
Okay. Really important that you as a law enforcement officer take down and put things in a report, right?
Yes.
Okay. Do you ever recall writing a report in this case?
No, because after I took him to transported him to the detention center, I had to go take calls out in the field.
Okay, so just never got around to writing a report.
Well, I was just there to observe and make sure he wasn't going to hurt himself or anybody else, you know? There was no words or anything like that exchanged between me and him.
A pattern seemed to be emerging. This was now the second BIA officer who admitted on the stand that they didn't write a report. And defense attorney Gosch, again, showed the jury why this is so detrimental, because there was no official record to reference what happened that night. Gosch asked Officer Audibeau if Gerard's apparent intoxication, his red and bloodshot eyes, could be because he was crying or from allergies. And Officer Audibeau said yes, because he had no record to prove whether Gerard was intoxicated.
So there was no report to back up Audibeau's observations from that night. But on top of that, Officer Audibeau admitted that he never requested any blood alcohol testing on Gerard. Even though he took him to the medical clinic and could have asked for a test there, Gerard's blood alcohol level was never officially determined the night Christie died.
But on this date, you have a dead body.
Mm-hmm.
You believe he's intoxicated, correct?
Yes.
You take him to the medical center, right?
Yes.
Because he's got visible injuries?
Yes.
And that's your protocol?
Yes.
Did you get a blood draw?
I did not.
Did you request one?
I did not.
Did, to your knowledge, did any law enforcement officer with the BIA request a blood draw?
To me, I can only answer for myself. I did not.
Once again, Officer Audibeau admitted to another major mistake. Even after Gerard admitted to the officers in his interview that he drank a couple bottles of alcohol that day and that he ran Christie over and then drove to his mother's house, no officer had Gerard's blood tested. When these details came out in the courtroom, we saw Christie's family squirm in their seats. Even if the officers assumed this was an accident, the BIA law enforcement handbook says if the officer concludes that the use of alcohol or drugs was a contributing factor in a severe car incident causing fatalities, the officer will ensure that a proper investigation is conducted, including the collection of appropriate evidence such as blood samples. But that didn't happen. So when it was time for the trial, there was no way to prove that Gerard was actually intoxicated that night. We learned later that Gerard was given a preliminary breath test that night, but according to court documents we obtained, those results were excluded by the judge before the trial began. The defense requested those preliminary breath test results be excluded because in previous cases, the reliability of these types of tests have been questioned. And so the judge agreed to keep the results out of the trial, except potentially on cross-examination should Gerard elect to testify. And so, with no blood drawn, there would be no blood alcohol content for Gerard.
Okay, so not writing a report in this case, that was a mistake.
Yes, it was.
Okay, and we all make mistakes, correct?
Well, yeah. No one is perfect.
There was one other moment with Audubon that, in a really simple way, showed how relying on memory, without reports, isn't always strong enough to prove something in a court of law. In their questioning, both the prosecution and the defense asked Audubon to identify Gerard in the courtroom for the record. But Audubon said, both times, that he couldn't because he said it's been a long time since that night.
Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Get up to 30% off well-crafted and personalized gifts from participating shops until May 12th. This year, embrace your creative side. You know, the side your mom gave you. And shop Etsy for custom jewelry, style pieces, home decor, and extra special items she'll adore. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
On the night of Christie's death, a third BIA officer, Melvin Rossman, responded, and he also testified during the trial. Rossman was a patrol officer that night, and at the time, he'd been working on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation for almost 2 years. We learned from his testimony that he responded to Gerard's mother's house that night and then received orders from Special Agent Whitefoot, the lead investigator on the case, to go to Christie's home in Muddy Cluster, investigate what happened there, and collect any evidence he could find. So Rossman and another officer got in their cruisers and drove the 7 or so miles to where Christie was run over. Officer Rossman told the jury that as they pulled into Muddy Cluster, he saw something in the road about 200 yards from the entrance of the neighborhood. He got out of his car and crouched down to find some black pieces of hard plastic. One was a broken car door handle. Rossman testified that he grabbed a ruler and placed it on the ground next to the pieces of debris. He snapped a few photos of the evidence. He then spotted a wet spot of blood on the road a couple feet away. He took his ruler and took a photo. After this, the officers left Muddy Cluster, and Officer Rossman drove back to Gerard's mother's. At some point that night, photos of Gerard's SUV were taken, and those photos were shown in the courtroom. They were a mixture of wide shots of the car, caked in mud from various angles, and some close-ups, which appeared to show some large streaks on the driver's side of the car where something had scuffed off some of the mud. Rossman told the jury that by the time he returned to Gerard's mother's house, officers had begun wrapping up their work at the scene. At this point, Gerard had been taken away, and Christie's body had been removed by the coroner. Rossman's final order that night was to transport the SUV away from the house so that it could be kept as evidence.
And the way Officer Rossman recounted for the prosecution how he collected evidence that night seemed to be mostly by the book. But defense attorney Gosch, through her cross-examination, quickly revealed a more disturbing version of events.
I want to ask you about something that you said, too. You actually drove the vehicle to, is it the BIA lockup or where did you take it?
I took it and parked it in front of the administration building at the police department.
And that's in Lame Deer, right?
In Lame Deer.
Okay, so you got physically in the vehicle and drove it?
Yes.
You didn't call for a tow?
No.
Were you wearing gloves?
I do not remember.
Okay, when you were taking pictures of the car, were you wearing gloves?
I was assisting with the pictures. I don't believe I took any pictures.
Okay, were you wearing gloves?
No.
Did you touch the car at all?
Yes.
Let me rephrase. That's a really poor question. Did you touch the outside of the car at all?
I could have. I don't recall if I did or not.
Okay, and... But you definitely touched the inside of the car because you drove it to the lot.
Yes.
Is that common practice for the BIA to not call for a tow to maintain the integrity of a crime scene such as a car?
No.
No, it's...
I'm not sure.
You're not sure?
Not sure.
Okay. Have you in other cases been asked to take vehicles to the BIA and leave them in that same area?
On certain occasions, yes.
So not only did Officer Rossman drive the car that ran Christy over rather than get it towed, he wasn't wearing gloves or any kind of protective gear when he did it.
And sitting in the courtroom, we were thinking that people who even casually watch CSI or 48 Hours know that evidence collection requires gloves. And to be fair, it seemed like in this case that the most vital evidence would have been collected from outside the SUV and the back seat where Gerard put Christy. But even so, Gosch seemed to be kicking up dirt here to continue with that crucial narrative that there was a pattern of these BIA officers seemingly making mistakes at the most basic levels of this investigation.
But more troubling details emerged as Gosch questioned Rossman, like where Gerard's SUV was driven that night.
Gosch compared photos of Gerard's SUV from the night Christy died, when the SUV was covered in mud, with the other investigative photographs submitted into evidence that Officer Rossman said were taken 4 days later.
If we could go to page 2 of Exhibit 12. Does that car look familiar to you, sir?
It appears to be that same vehicle, yes.
And does that vehicle appear to be caked in mud?
No, it does not.
If you know, sir, was that vehicle always maintained in a locked container or evidence storage facility?
I believe after the search by, or that agent Whitefoot did, I believe it was parked back in our secured lot.
And is that secured lot covered?
It is not covered, no.
Okay, so this car would have been since approximately March 2020, left out in the open.
Yes.
Okay, so it would have been subject to weather, rain, snow, things like that?
Yes.
Okay, and that would have changed the integrity of this piece of evidence.
The integrity?
Yeah, such as the mud markings are no longer on the vehicle.
Yes.
Okay, so this piece of evidence is not in the same condition as it was when you took it to the BIA evidence lockup in March 2020.
No, not the mud that we're talking about.
And the defense attorney also got Officer Rossman to admit that the car remained sitting outside of the BIA police station in a locked-up chain-link fence for the last 21 months since Christy died. When we were listening to these revelations about the car that ran Christy over, the main piece of evidence, we looked over to see Christy's family members with their heads in their hands during this testimony.
With that, the prosecution and defense wrapped their questions of the three BIA officers. It became clear that the jury wouldn't be hearing any more details about the BIA's actions because the special agent in charge, Jonathan Whitefoot, responsible for the investigation that night and in the months that followed, didn't testify, leaving so many questions about Christy's case unanswered. We asked the U.S. Attorney's Office why Special Agent Whitefoot wasn't called to testify since he was the lead agent on this case. In a short statement, U.S. Attorney Jesse Loslovich said his office was respectfully declining to comment on this question because the answers involved trial strategy decisions made based on the facts of the case and the federal rules of evidence. The three officers who testified had a combined 42 years of law enforcement experience between them. They all graduated from the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in New Mexico called the U.S. Indian Police Academy and were required to complete annual training.
But even with this experience, the gravity of the officer's errors lingered, even as the trial shifted focus to expert testimony explaining how Christy died. Besides the three BIA agents who testified, there were three medical experts Prosecutor Day called to the stand. Because to argue his case, he needed to prove how Christy died and that it was Gerard's fault.
And Kara, the jury's interest seemingly peaked as they listened to a vehicular crash expert testify. As a witness for the prosecution, he used diagrams and at times got off the stand to explain that when Christy was beside Gerard's driver door, her hand somehow became trapped in the door handle. During his testimony, the expert explained that his research led him to conclude that as Gerard drove away, he accelerated, fast enough that Christy couldn't keep up. With her hand caught in the door, Christy fell to the ground. At the same time, her right foot became lodged under the back wheel. According to the expert, this created a whipping motion, trapping Christy under the wheel and snapping her body to the ground. He said Christy didn't rip off Gerard's door handle in a fit of rage. This whipping motion provided enough force for Christy's trapped body to snap the handle off. Christy was then dragged by the car, but the expert said there wasn't enough evidence collected to determine how far. The crash expert also used medical records to create a diagram of Christy's injuries. The jury saw on the expert's diagram that Christy's 5'2" frame had head-to-toe contusions, including on her brain, plus 7 fractured ribs, a fractured right ankle, and a tear to 2 parts of her heart. The expert said Christy's official cause of death was multiple blunt force injuries. But prior to this testimony from the vehicular crash expert, jurors heard from Montana's chief medical examiner, who conducted Christy's autopsy. He said that Christy died as a result of the injury she sustained and classified Christy's manner of death as an accident, meaning there was little or no evidence that the injuries occurred with intent to harm or cause death. In essence, the fatal outcome was unintentional. And lastly, it should be noted that the defense called one expert, an accident reconstructionist, in an attempt to argue that there was no evidence that Gerard was drunk or drove recklessly. But Prosecutor Dake attacked the soundness of this expert's findings in cross-examination. We found out through his testimony that this expert had an expired accreditation. And after the trial, we called the Accreditation Commission for Traffic Accident Reconstruction and were told his accreditation expired in 2006. At the end of the trial, with his closing argument, Assistant U.S. Attorney Dake tried to make the case as simple as possible for the jury. Dake implored the jury to understand that Gerard was charged with involuntary manslaughter, which meant that intent wasn't relevant in this case. Perhaps Gerard didn't purposely kill Christy, but his actions led to her death. And those actions were that Gerard had been drinking. Dake said Gerard made reckless decisions. Most importantly, accelerating the Ford Explorer with Christy next to the car. Dake's argument was that the crime doesn't occur if the car doesn't move.
You don't check your common sense at the door. You don't check your common sense at the door when you become a juror in this case. And that's exactly what this is telling you. Why is that important here? Because when you think about it, a car doesn't move sideways, but a car doesn't move without the driver in the car. And it's the driver in the car that's responsible for the death of Christy Woodenthigh.
But in her closing remarks, defense attorney Gosch told the jury that Christy was the cause of her own demise. She reiterated that at the time of her death, Christy was 3 times over the legal drinking limit, while no one conducted a field sobriety test on Gerard. She also reminded the jury that Christy had meth in her system, which a toxicology expert confirmed at the trial. But defense attorney Gosch never let the jury forget about the failures of the BIA officers. She argued that their testimony established a pattern of mistakes over and over again. But in her final words to the jury, she told them there could only be one reason why they made the choices they did.
you have to believe that these law enforcement officers, again, are either completely incompetent, the worst that you've ever seen, or you have to believe that there was a motive and a reason why they didn't do those things. And it's because there wasn't a crime. They didn't think he did anything wrong. No law enforcement agency consistently, through all those officers, makes that many mistakes. It's unheard of.
The trial in the case of the United States versus Gerard David Three Fingers lasted 2 days. The jury was left to decide whether to convict Gerard of involuntary manslaughter. The judge instructed the jury to take everything they had heard and determine if Gerard drove recklessly while under the influence, and in doing so, was responsible for running Christy over, which caused her death. If they found him not guilty, Gerard would walk free. Even after the BIA blunders were exposed on the stand, Christy's family still had hope that Gerard would be convicted. To them, the case was simple. While the jury was deliberating, Rael Roland, Christy's best friend, told us it was impossible to think about anything but the officer's testimony.
You would think that if they pulled up and seen Christy deceased in the back of the vehicle, that they would have went above and beyond to take notes and do their reporting.
Bo and I started discussing all the things that seemed obvious to us that weren't brought up in the trial. The prosecution never brought up that Christy was a beloved friend, sister, and mother. No one from her family testified. It was never mentioned that, according to Christy's family, she was allegedly a victim of domestic abuse for years at the hand of the man on trial.
And no one mentioned that this was the second time Gerard had been charged with involuntary manslaughter while driving a vehicle. We found out later that this was because the prior conviction was only admissible at trial if Gerard testified, which he did not do.
And there were other things that were brought up during the trial, but didn't seem adequately fleshed out.
Like those alleged scratches on Gerard's face. The jury was told Gerard needed medical attention, and they were shown pictures of Gerard's face with blood on it. But we don't really know where those scratches came from. It seemed like in the courtroom, it was implied that these scratches came from Christy allegedly assaulting Gerard, which, remember, was a major narrative of the defense's opening statement. And later on, when we got the pictures of Gerard from that night and got to take a closer look at him, it seems hard to tell if the blood was from the scabbed over scratches on Gerard's face, or potentially if that was Christy's blood from when Gerard picked her up and put her in his vehicle. We tried to reach Gerard to get his version of events through his attorney and family, but we never heard back. We also tried numerous times to get the BIA to respond to our questions about these officers' actions and how the investigation was conducted, but they never responded to our requests.
During the trial, we also paid a lot of attention to the jury.
And more often than not, as a whole, they seemed pretty unengaged. It appeared only one juror, a young man, was ever jotting down notes regularly. And we wrote in our notes during the toxicologist testimony, one woman in the jury seemed like she was falling asleep.
After just 45 minutes of deliberating, the jury made their decision.
So our family was all sitting there, had our fingers crossed, said our prayers, and the jury handed the judge a piece of paper, and she read it, and they found Gerard Three Fingers not guilty of involuntary manslaughter. And all you could hear was everybody sigh, all the family, all my family, and it's all sighed. And we just all looked, and we were like in shock. It's like, sad.
Even in her disbelief, Alita never took her eyes off Gerard.
He just stood there. He didn't even look up. He just had his head down and then said not guilty. He didn't even look up. He didn't even smile.
They waited 648 days for this verdict. 648 days since Christy's death.
We all just stood there in shock. Some of us were crying. Some of us were mad. A couple of them were cussing. And it was just a shocking. I was mostly angry. I don't feel like justice was served. I feel like we have to serve justice ourselves.
Next time on Missing Justice. The aftershock of Gerard's trial is felt throughout the entire Northern Cheyenne community because other cases have also raised concerns.
You can get away with murder here. People get away with murder here. That's all. I hear comments like that all the time.
How could the BIA officers make such mistakes?
That's very frustrating to me, to see the crime happening in my community and there's very little to nothing I can do about it.
So tribal leaders began taking steps to address law enforcement issues on the reservation, for Christy and for others. And ultimately, they felt there was no other option but to take on the United States government.
They had 60 days to respond to us. 60 days came and went with no response whatsoever.
Missing Justice is a CBS News podcast. This episode was reported by me, Kara Cordy, and Bo Erickson. If you want to get in touch with us, email missingjustice@cbsnews.com. We wanted to thank the Northern Cheyenne people for their hospitality and for sharing their stories with us. This project was also reported and produced in part in Washington, D.C., so we wanted to acknowledge that we work from the ancestral homelands of the Anacostan and neighboring Piscataway and Pamunkey Indigenous peoples. Dr. Iris Prettypaint, a member of Blackfeet Nation and a descendant of the Crow Nation, worked with us as a sensitivity reader. She has over 45 years of experience as an educator and is a leading authority on cultural resilience with American Indian and Alaska Native communities. Steve Razies is the Executive Vice President of Podcasting and Audio at Paramount. At CBS News, Ingrid Ciprian Matthews is the Executive Vice President of News Gathering, and Mark Lima is our DC Bureau Chief. A special thanks to our voice actors, CBS producer Julie Morse as Jillian Gosch, Luca Javier as Officer Harley Walker, Joey Sorlis as Officer Melvin Rossman, and Phil Ava as Officer Marlon Audubon. Our production partner is Neon Hum Media. At Neon Hum, our executive producer is Jonathan Hirsch. Our senior producer is Joanna Clay. Liz Sanchez is our associate producer. Stephanie Serrano is our associate editor. Original music by Asha Ivanovich. Sound design by Scott Somerville. Additional tracks from Epidemic Sound. And our fact checker is Naomi Barr. Thanks for listening.
If you like Face the Nation with Margaret Brennan, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Catch every episode of 60 Minutes, America's most watched news magazine show, as a podcast. Hear in-depth investigations across politics, news, and entertainment on your schedule. Listen to 60 Minutes ad-free on Wondery Plus.
Are you ready for an all-new season of Survivor? You better be, because Survivor 46 is here, and it's 90 minutes of twists and turns you don't want to miss. Better yet, after each episode, there's a brand new episode of On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast. Each week, we go behind the scenes of the episode's biggest moments, taking you into the how and the why things happened. And this season, we're very lucky to be joined by an expert, the winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares.
What is up? I'm thrilled to be joining this team and to be giving you my take on how and the why players made the moves they did, what it takes to outwit, outplay, and outlast, and to ask Jeff some questions, because even after 26 days out there, there is still a lot for me to uncover.
Bring it, D. Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.